You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
So I'd like to welcome everyone to the Brookings Institution and thank you for coming out today. So there's been a lot of fun talk about some revelations that have kept a lot of us busy over the past few weeks dealing with surveillance. And rather predictably, a lot of that discussion has been focused on the privacy of American citizens, but the challenge is, in a global internet, we have to actually acknowledge that the data that flows across the global networks belongs to many people, not just Americans. And when we have the defense that is coming from the administration saying, well, one of the reasons why this type of surveillance isn't so bad is there are strict rules making sure that we're not looking at American data. That gives us some idea of what the rhetoric and the tone and the narrative is going to be. And the problem is narratives and stories are actually very important when we're dealing with policies like internet governance, when we're trying to establish how we're going to manage this shared network. And so to talk about this today, I'm joined by Gene Kimmelman and Jason Healy. So Gene is a senior associate for the Global Partners Associates, and he is the director of Internet Freedom and Human Rights Program for the New America Foundation. Prior to that, he was in the antitrust division of the Department of Justice, where he ran their Competition Policy and Intergovernmental Regulations Program. He came there from a long career of defending consumer interests. As the vice president of Consumers Union, spent some time running the global consumer interest organization, Consumer International, and before that he was on the Hill and worked with the Consumer Federation of America. So, Gene, thank you for being here. Yeah. We're also joined by Jason Healy, who's the director for Cyber Statecraft Initiative at the Atlantic Council. He has a new book, Fierce Domain, Cyber Conflict from 1986 to 2012, which is the first history of conflict in cyberspace. And he also has a previous book. He's the co-author of the Cybersecurity Policy Guidebook. Jason has a long career thinking about cyber policy, both as a scholar at the Atlantic Council. In the public sector, 2003-2005, he worked in the White House as the director for Cyber Information Infrastructure Protection. He was in the private sector thinking about security for Goldman Sachs and actually bridged the public-private gap as the vice president for the financial services ISAC. And he began his career in information security in the Air Force. So thank you for joining us. So we're going to start by just bringing everyone up to speed on what we're talking about, in case you've never heard of this thing called the National Securities Agency. And but before we do, just a quick reminder to please turn off your cell phone. And if you are interested in following along on social media, you can track our hashtag TechCTI. And Jason Healy is on Twitter at Jason_Healy. So what have we learned? Well, June 6th, June 7th, we had a couple of revelations that came out and broke between the Guardian newspaper and then most notably in the Washington Post, announcing that there were some very large surveillance programs that we didn't know about. Now, the goal of today's event is not to actually get into the details of what these programs are, their specific intended purposes, the merits of those purposes. There are lots of people talking about their uses in anti-terrorism, but to talk about the impressions and the narratives and what people are saying about them. So even as we've learned more about what the programs are involved in this PRISM program, the Washington Post reported that the National Security Agency had data that was collected directly from the servers of U.S. service providers, Microsoft, Yahoo, Google, Facebook, PayPal, AOL, Skype, YouTube, Apple. The Post also reported that 1 in 7 intelligence reports involved data from this. Now, their source were these slides that were leaked to The Guardian from a gentleman who is no longer employed by Booz Allen Hamilton. But again, the story as it initially broke was that American companies were participating knowingly. They hinted also at access to international switches, something that the slides referred to as Blarney or Fairview, indicating that there might be much wider access to digital metadata around the world. And we want to focus on these initial claims because people are still talking about them. People are still using the rhetoric. There is a rather ornery but long-lived tech columnist, John C. Dvorak, who's been writing about the technology industry pretty much since the invention of the PC itself. And he sort of was insistent in saying, listen, it's possible these companies are still compliant. He's still using the initial story that broke in the Post. So why is this important? Well, the challenge is not just the surveillance question, but to put it in the broader context of what the global network means. And this is not something that is just about facts, it's also about impressions. The question of internet governance is a large and messy issue. It covers some technical issues, it covers economic issues, but it is shaped around two general narratives. One narrative says the status quo of a multi-stakeholder process that's managed under the existing institutions, the International Corporation for Assigning Names and Numbers, does a great job. It helps keep the internet open and free. The U.S. House of Representatives issued a resolution last year saying that this was a goal, that the American government must continue to uphold this kind of institution, this multi-stakeholder approach, so that everyone can access it and no one is really involved in controlling what's going on. Another alternative view says, well, we don't think this multi-stakeholder approach is actually all that multi-stakeholder. We think that ICANN, because it was founded by some American law firms and had the support of American scholars, is an American front. ICANN, by the way, is one of those rare organizations that is an answer to the question, who died and made you king? John Postel, who is the inventor of DNS, one of the leaders of the Internet Architecture Board, passed away without a full proper understanding of how we were going to manage the domain name system. So we have ICANN, and that in turn has taken over a lot of the governance issues. But there are other things involved as well. The competing vision of ICANN has coalesced around the idea that the ITU, the International Telecommunications Union, can help manage this. It's a representative body. It's affiliated with the UN, even though it predates the UN. It originally was established to help determine how telegraph messages would cross borders in an era of national telegraph standards. And so there were these two competing visions. One says it should be an international representative approach where every country should have a fair share, and we can figure out priorities from that perspective. The other approach said, no, it must be open and free, and we're afraid that if we make it along the lines of a UN representative body, we will bring in values that are not currently part of the internet. We will allow countries to impose their will on the global internet and begin to change things. They'll close things off. They'll advocate censorship. Every country will have their interests advocated, and that will fragment the internet. So these two approaches came to a head in Dubai last year, and Gene's going to talk about that in a second. But the challenge has been, how do we take these two narratives and look at them in light of the recent surveillance information? These disclosures that have said, well, unfortunately, this global internet has a strong American hand in it. Again, we're going to talk about how we communicate the impressions rather than the exact details. So, Gene, I was hoping you could start us off and talk a little about the internet governance side of things.
Yeah, so thank you, Alan. I appreciate the invitation. I'm going to take you away from ICANN, where you left us. Leave all those thoughts there as the relevant impressions and enter the debate about the World Conference on International Telecommunications, the WICCAT in Dubai. And I want to give you a perspective working for Global Partners in New America. I'm working closely with human rights activists and nonprofits around the world. So this is really a kind of amalgam of my impressions of how they perceive this whole policy debate developing. There was all this hype about regulating the internet and censorship versus an open internet, as you described, but not so much in ICANN terms, in a broader sense of internet policies. And what I perceived is that there were really a lot of legitimate policy issues that were floating around going into this discussion starting a year ago in preparation for the Dubai Treaty Conference. How to expand access to the internet in countries that can't afford it or haven't even gotten access to undersea cables, don't have IXPs that are local. How to address broader cost issues ranging from roaming costs and interconnection costs. How to protect national security, as is part of our broader discussion, and concerns about how to address legitimate issues related to content regulation, protection of children, free speech, but broader cultural context of what's allowed, what's not allowed. Some might call censorship, other might call legitimate public oversight. These were all very legitimate issues that many of the countries involved and many of the human rights activists and nonprofits want to debate. And the difficulty for all of them was, where do you do this? Where do you take this? Is this purely a national issue? Is it a regional issue? Or is it something that does have legitimate global intersection, whether it's the ITU or somewhere else? And that was the environment that I saw developing going into the treaty conference. Then I think these very legitimate issues ran headlong into an enormous geopolitical conflict between some countries that truly do want to directly regulate and use an international body to help them control their oversight of communications platforms in their own countries, and those who truly believe the internet should be as open as possible, recognizing that there are legitimate national infrastructure regulatory issues and global standard setting and spectrum management and other important issues that require international cooperation. But that conflict, that conflagration, made it virtually impossible to debate these issues that many wanted to do. Now, many of the civil society organizations and nonprofits I worked with converged around a set of demands going into this treaty conference related to the fundamental lack of transparency, openness, the multi-stakeholder attributes that are missing in the whole ITU structure, but also gravitated towards desiring a global policy debate around three important issue areas: affordable access to communications platforms, notably broadband where possible, issues related to discriminatory practices or non-discrimination requirements, whether net neutrality or something similar, on platforms, and personal security of citizens or privacy interests versus surveillance. Those were the issues people wanted to see debated. It never really happened, as you point out, at the treaty conference. The overreaching of a number of nations who wanted to regulate and go too far stymied any possibility of a real positive, meaningful discussion. And most of the civil society organizations lined up with the U.S., Europe, India, Kenya, and others opposing the ultimate treaty. Now, I want to point out, notably, that there were many developing countries who care about those issues and want to see a global debate and consideration of some global processes who signed the treaty, I think, as much confused or unsure as to whether it should be the ITU or someone else, but not wanting to give up that possibility. And I want to come back to that later as an important issue for us to think about. Now, the parallel interest between civil society and governments opposing the treaty and many of the U.S.-based multinational corporations that were involved in the treaty discussion continued through this spring as civil society pressed forward with demands of the ITU to open up, to be more transparent, to include civil society in its debates, and again, to continue carrying forward substantive discussions of these important issues: privacy, access, issues of discrimination. Then the NSA stories hit the media. And now I think we face a very significant loss of confidence from many of these groups, both in how to think about the role of the United States going forward in internet policy and the role of the U.S.-based multinational corporations, telecommunications, and internet providers alike. Now, I think to be clear, everyone who is serious about these issues is debating and is debating the significance of the NSA revelations, understands that neither surveillance nor privacy are absolutes, but instead involve checks and balances and a variety of factors. But within this context, here is, I think, the way this is coming across for my communications with these groups as this has gone forward. There are three lenses. First is the government lens, which is predominantly trust us. We're the U.S. government. We live under a constitution. We have the Patriot Act. We have the Surveillance Act. We abide by the law. We have checks and balances. There are these standards out there. We have court review. It's really okay. The second lens is the corporate lens, which is, well, whether or not you trust the government, trust us, because we really hand over as little as we possibly can. We fight like crazy. We will not reveal our customers' information. We really don't want to. And we're being, our hands are tied because we can't really even talk about this because of U.S. law. And then the third lens is what both you're seeing from outside and from nonprofit groups in the U.S., which is we're not sure we trust either of those two because the standards are sort of vague. The court process, more secretive than our normal judicial review process. The applications of the law, depending on what ends up being accurate when we finally get the facts out, may be looser than we thought and not as carefully calculated and calibrated to protect personal information. And the companies, yes, they should be able to reveal more about how many government requests, how many accounts, but are they really fighting as hard as they can to protect their customers' interests? Is Twitter different than everybody else? Why are they not doing what Twitter is doing? And what else could they or should they be doing? And so I think you have a set of perceptions around the world that may have emanated from those original observations about ICANN and the U.S. control that have now exploded across this broad surveillance landscape. So just yesterday, the groups that I was working with who had been in substantial alignment with the U.S. and most of these companies, sent a letter to Congress and the White House challenging the U.S. government and these companies to explain their information sharing and surveillance practices and demonstrating that they do not constitute violations of human rights charters and the U.S.'s own commitments to those charters as a signatory. Now, we don't often in this country talk about human rights charters. Isn't that interesting? Everywhere else in the world, they talk about them all the time. So let me just quote from this letter. The contradiction between the persistent affirmation of human rights online by the U.S. government and the recent allegations of what appear to be mass surveillance of U.S. and non-citizens, non-U.S. citizens, by the same government is very disturbing and carries negative repercussions on the global stage. But even more importantly, what the letter points out is, what about us? We're not U.S. citizens. We don't live in the U.S. So it goes on, and I'll quote. In all the post-disclosure statements, U.S. authorities have only insisted that there was no access obtained to content related to U.S. citizens. There has not been a word on the issue of large-scale access to content related to non-U.S. citizens, which constitutes an almost certain human rights violation. The focusing of the U.S. authorities on the difference between treatment of U.S. citizens and non-citizens on an issue which essentially relates to violation of human rights is very problematic. And then it's not just the government. Here's what they add in the letter. I quote again, of equal concern is the indication of apparent complicity of some U.S.-based internet companies with global reach. These revelations suggest blatant and systemic disregard for human rights as articulated in Article 17 and 19 of the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights, as well as Articles 12 and 19 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. That's strong stuff. And these are the groups that aligned with the U.S.-based companies and the U.S. government up until a few weeks ago. So I don't want to go into the depth of what we might ultimately do with this, but I want to just conclude by highlighting that I think it's time for the U.S. government and the U.S. companies that care about internet policy and provide internet service, to wake up to the enormity of the global challenges to internet policy that result from this discussion. And I think it's important to understand that surveillance without full respect for human rights is a recipe for disaster to an open internet. Thank you.
So, thank you, Gene. So I want to move from the civil society approach to the international relations and security sphere, just to give you an idea of some of the reaction that we've seen around the world. Everything from a mild claim, from a rather understated claim from a German official who said, why is it fair that a U.S. judge gets to decide the privacy of a German citizen? So I think that sort of frames this in legal terms, versus in a more aggressive move. The deputy speaker of the lower house of the Russian parliament said, we're going to introduce a new policy that will require all foreign websites to register in Russian territory. That would give essentially Russian security services the same ability that Americans do. And then I think the final note, to help put this in the context of security, is even something that was built to be secure against government monitoring, Bitcoin, the cryptographic currency, when this was announced, June 6th and 7th, was the second largest sell-off in recent history, and it lost about over 10% of its value in 2 days, just because they decided that this now means that even Bitcoin is no longer secure. So, Jason, can you talk about some of the security and relations?
Even Bitcoin?
Even Bitcoin.
Even Bitcoin. So, hey, good afternoon, everyone. Thanks for coming. So, look, in the past, I started out my career as a signals intelligence officer. So I did my time listening to other people, and I guess I hadn't actually been thinking about their human rights in that context. Although I was in that role, responsible at my unit if we gathered information on U.S. citizens. We were a site that actually happened to be on U.S. soil, and it came up a couple times a month where we actually would accidentally pick up someone. Turns out, it was often a fishing boat or someone else that was doing stuff. Operators were trained not to open an official file until they were certain it wasn't a U.S. person. If it did, they weren't in trouble. They were frowned at. But we had procedures to then take care of this information and make sure that it didn't make it in, it certainly didn't make it into reports, and that we would go about taking it out of the records to make sure it didn't happen, so that it didn't stay collected. So overall, I'm pretty confident about the process that went into this being legal and constitutional with regard to U.S. citizens. Although I got to say, the scope and scale of it leaves me as a former SIGINT guy pretty gasping at the audacity and the scale of what happened. And the analogy that I look at, if you're dealing with Intel guys, especially collectors, and whether that's NSA or any other countries, is that they want to collect, as an analogy, a copy of every book that's ever been printed, even if they happen to get U.S. books in that. But I'll tell you, if they're going to look at any single page that happens to be an American citizen's page, the restrictions come in. So, yes, the information gets collected, but actually accessing those on American citizens is quite restricted. I'm also fairly confident that information has been useful, even critical, in stopping some of these terrorist plots that we've heard of. But as we just heard from, that's also sort of beside the point of this conversation right here. So I'd like to cover what I think is really the root of the issue when you're dealing, especially about the United States government on this. And that's, I think, this town within the Beltway is pretty wrong in their thinking about America's true cyber power. There was a time when, if you talked about America's maritime power, that you didn't think of the United States Navy. You thought of America's merchant seamen and our merchant ships that were sailing around the world bringing American commerce. And that was America's true cyber power. And the Navy was there to help make sure that happened. We don't really think of it that way anymore. To some degree, the same was true for the American air power, where it was the men and women that were zooming around in the Dayton Air races and doing daring things and pushing the aircraft farther and inventing new aircraft. And neither of those are true. If you think about American air power, maritime power now, you jump to the military. And this town, when they think about American cyber power, they think about what's off Route 32. They think about the National Security Agency and U.S. Cyber Command. And as far as they think about what cyber power might actually mean, we generally wait for General Alexander to tell us what it actually is. And that's not really what American cyber power is. American cyber power isn't off Route 32. It's off Route 128 in Boston. And it's out in Silicon Valley. It's the companies and other non-states that are creating cyberspace. They're building it with their own money. They're maintaining it for their own purposes. And those artists and companies that are filling it with content that Americans and the rest of the world want. And because we are so flawed in our thinking about what America's true cyberpower is, that's really where I see the impact from these revelations coming. Not just this, but also Stuxnet and other areas where you can see that we've taken these decisions that help this hard power, this military cyberpower, the intelligence community cyberpower. And it's really putting at risk the larger cyber power. And by compelling American companies to participate, completely not in their shareholders' interests or their customers' interests, to participate in American hard cyber power, we really are putting this larger American cyber power at risk. And I think we might even be putting the future of cyberspace itself at risk. In this sense, I think the Chinese, I don't say this too often, but I think the Chinese have it right when they look at American cyber power. Because when I've talked to mainland colleagues, they will keep saying, look, when we see it, when we look at cyberspace, the geography of cyberspace, whenever we look at the high ground, we see America. We see Microsoft and Cisco and Intel and Twitter and Facebook. And IBM, all of these American companies, and we feel they're backed by Cyber Command and the National Security Agency. So they see, I think, pretty accurately that America has the high ground in cyberspace. In fact, I think this town, when we do think of it, we tend to think of cyberspace as an American lake, right? I mean, it's a place that's largely dominated by the U.S., and we can use it. It's a place to dominate, right? You hear this in a lot of the military doctrine. You know, the U.S. Navy has their information dominance corps, the InfoDom guys. So we really are in this town seized up by that. So, what's the impact of this? What I see three or four different ways that this can impact us in internet governance largely. One, I think it would be a very rational reaction for foreign companies, people, and governments. It would be very natural for them to try and choose to avoid U.S. cyberspace wherever they can, such as by finding alternate routes, if they can find routes that don't go through the United States. The protocols don't always allow that, but you could try and do it. There are ways that you could try and do it, especially through submarine cable routes and the rest. Or they could start building their own infrastructure and companies rather than relying on U.S. companies. If by touching U.S. shores in any way is going to make you more open to collection, whether that's at a U.S. data center, whether that's U.S. Submarine cables that touch on the United States, a company that's domiciled in the United States, it would certainly be a rational and natural reaction for companies to decide to avoid that. Some might do it for national security reasons. You know, if Russia or China say that's gonna be out, it could happen for data privacy reasons, and that would be a very natural thing for the European Union to do. Obviously, that's gonna be to the detriment of U.S. companies and ultimately to U.S. cyber power. And frankly, it could help the further balkanization of the internet that you now see this reimposition of national boundaries, not necessarily through formal governance mechanisms like the ITU or WICCET or changes to ICANN or the ITU, but just nations decide that information has to be domiciled in their own countries so that it doesn't touch the United States. So a second way that it might affect is that U.S. companies, many of which, as we see through tax, already might feel a very tenuous connection to the United States to begin with, it would be very natural for them to decide that they will start cutting their connections to the United States so that they're no longer headquartered here, no longer have data centers here, so that they will no longer be compelled by the United States government to act in this way. Now, that's somewhat theoretical, I think, at this point, because if they're going to other countries, if they're going to Germany, Russia, China, I mean, lots of countries do what the United States just got caught doing. They just don't have the opportunities to be so awesome at it as NSA was. But if you now start seeing these data centers appearing in these other countries, it's likely, to happen. You can imagine India or other countries. You already start seeing some of this. I was in the finance sector, and you'd see rules about what could or could not happen. Taiwan, you could not hold their data off Taiwan, so it restricted what we could do at Goldman Sachs with our data centers. So this would be, I think, a very natural next step out of that. Also, of course, as got brought up, it might also hurt actual governance, including negotiations at the ITU, along with bilateral relations with Russia and China. So I think it's certainly more likely today than it was 3 months ago that things will go against the United States in this, and that we might wake up 5 years from now and have an internet that has more Chinese characteristics than American hippie characteristics, which is largely what we have now. Fortunately, there's some good signs here. Just when these revelations were hitting, happened to be one of the most exciting times in the 15 years that I've been involved with this for international agreements. You got the United States, the presidents of the United States and Russia. You thought I was going to say China. Presidents of the United States and Russia agree to confidence-building measures. So these revelations didn't throw off that joint agreement between the presidents of Russia and the United States to say, if we're having a conflict or if we're having an escalating crisis, we'll have hotlines, we'll have all these other confidence-building measures. A good sign. It also did not hurt the negotiations that we've seen so far. It appears we've got a successful agreement between the UN group of government expert countries, including Russia, China, Great Britain, Germany, lots of others. Now, that was mostly focused on military matters, but it was coming out right at the same time as the revelations, and these countries agreed that existing international law does apply. So international humanitarian law, laws of armed conflict, does apply. They also agreed that the internet should be free and open. I can't remember the exact phrases, but they said that. That's great. So we have two things that could have gone off the rails because of the revelations and didn't. So there's room for hope. And last, of course, we had President Obama and President Xi that met. And this probably, almost certainly weakened President Obama's hand in those discussions. But there are ways it didn't seem to have done so catastrophically. So for my summation, in the White House's international strategy for cyberspace that was really fantastic. President Obama came out and said, we can either work together to realize potential for greater prosperity and security, or we can succumb to narrow interests and undue fears which limit progress. The digital world is no longer a lawless frontier nor the province of a small elite. The more that we've been seeing exactly how much Washington, D.C. is kind of gripped, I think, with a particular view of what national security means and how you can use cyberspace to achieve national security, I've kind of stopped believing that the U.S. government acts as if it wants that future that President Obama talked about. Of course, parts of the United States government absolutely do. But those that believe in that future have no ability to really rein in the national security apparatus, which acts as if cyberspace is a U.S. lake in which the U.S. government can and should dominate.
Well, thank you. So I like that perspective. And Gene, do you have some thoughts about what the U.S. government can do or what other actors can do to help move us back into a more productive thing to avoid some of Jason's dystopic visions?
Well, I think that I'll try to jump off of your context. It's time for the U.S. government to look inward and have that internal conversation between the security elements and those who do foreign policy and those who care about human rights and those who care about civil rights, and come up with a plan of further disclosure, transparency, that actually puts some meat on the bones on what are the checks and balances that we apply, addresses the hard issues where there are ambiguities about whether we need to reinterpret our implementation of law or go back to the Congress and seek modifications. There are already bipartisan bills looking at Section 215 of the Patriot Act. So I think it's time to really step up, bring the government together, and have that unified vision of what the policy should be. On the corporate side, I think it's not just disclosures of what has been banned so far, but I think there ought to be an inward look at what are best practices. How does corporate America that wants to be a global leader and wants to expand markets protect human rights? There has to be a balancing of a commercial interest in profit with respect for human rights that we claim to abide by. I think we need to be much more proactive.
So there's a very interesting precedent here. I got my start in cryptography. And for a decade in the 90s, it was there was a movement that wanted to legalize cryptography, serious, strong protection of the government to be able to prevent people from people like Jason from reading our mail. And it was framed as human rights versus security. And in fact, the advocates for more open crypto policy talked about the four horsemen of the infopocalypse, which are still around today. It's drug dealers, money launderers, child pornographers, and terrorists. And you can actually find all four of them in many hearings today. And that was the battle line, and security won. And then along comes commerce. Along comes the commercial web, where you actually needed this stuff in order to advance and have a networked economy, and that blew both of them apart, and now we have flourishing, public, accessible crypto, except in those countries who still try to limit it for their own citizens. So Jason, do you have some thoughts on how we can get out of this mess?
One of my colleagues pointed out to me the other day that one of the reasons that we're having this right now, that NSA has been so active at trying to collect this other information, is specifically because they lost the crypto battle. And because things are, you know, everyone is able to encrypt the four horsemen, that they needed other ways to get that information, and the only way to do that was by casting such a wide net. So it was interesting if that's accurate in this back and forth. And what I really find too bad for the administration right now here in the U.S. is it didn't have to be this way. I think one of the reasons that this has shocked us so much, or amongst the several reasons, is that this administration in particular has been so soaring in their statements about an open and free internet. If you read the president's International Strategy for Cyberspace, it is a fantastic document that really asserts American principles and what we're looking for here. And it says, it has some bit that says, you know what, if we're attacked, we can do things back. But it doesn't give you, it doesn't let us balance and say that, you know what, espionage is going to happen also. It sets out a wonderful vision, but doesn't say, you know what, but still the world's a gritty place. And in this gritty real world, yes, there's still going to be some espionage that happens, and that's going to happen in cyberspace. But you know what? It can be rare. It can be minimally intrusively done. It can be done in a way that generally respects human rights and is better for human rights in the end. It doesn't come out and say, give you room, when we learned about Stuxnet, to say, wait a minute, where in the White House strategy, or frankly even the DoD strategy, does it say that the United States, that we'll do these things? All we read about is these wonderful statements about a shining internet and that how we're under attack. You know, the DoD strategy mentions the word attack only once, and then it's only talking about the bad guys attacking, and it never even uses the word offense. And the only time the White House strategy mentions U.S. And the White House document never mentions U.S. espionage, it only mentions the other guy's espionage and how that's a bad thing. So that was, we were setting ourselves up by completely overclassifying the kinds of things that we do and why those are good things. I mean, if you see some of these leaks that have come out, It's even been classified that, you know, the United States will conduct these operations in line with U.S. law and the Constitution. That's classified in some of these. And so I think the administration has really set themselves up by not having enough transparency, like Gene just mentioned. So I think what to do about this is a few things. So one, we ought to put a stronger balance in this post-9/11 culture to step ourselves away from the overclassification and just a single, very securitized view of what national security means. Now, actually, I think that's probably too far to consider right now. I think trying to establish that is going to be extraordinarily difficult. There's a few other more practical things. The president has already ordered to try and be more transparent about this and to even rein in some of this collection, if that can be done without too much loss. To me, that's almost even similar to what he talked about in Guantanamo. You know, there were some of these enhanced interrogation methods. We're not going to do that anymore. I think that would be fair to continue and maybe even extend that to give a more political view on what he's being told by his largely military national security team. I also think it would help a lot to release a new cyber strategy. We haven't released an actual cyber strategy since 2003 that actually balances these, that talks about how wonderful the Internet's going to be, how it should be secure, open, and free, how we're absolutely committed to that, but also throwing in and saying we have to do these gritty real-world things here and just talk about some of the balances that are going to happen. Talk about some of the checks that's going to make this okay. Tell us why this is okay for us to do as America and how it fits in with the articles and the Declaration of Human Rights, how it fits in with the UN Charter and other areas. I think that'd be even better if they, when they write that, they put the non-states like companies at the center of that and really consider them. When it comes to internet governance, there's a few other things that we could do. One, I think it would help if we came up with a real role for the ITU. We've been talking about this for years, and we've been letting the ITU gradually do more and more. And I'm an internationalist. I believe in the UN and the ITU. We needed the ITU when we had national networks, and we had to invent something like it so we could interconnect national networks. The Internet's already international, right? It's internet. So if we allow the ITU and the UN to get too UN-ish about this, we're going to end up with separate internets. We're going to get nationalized internet. So I think the U.S. should absolutely pile on to the ITU, especially with things like capacity developing. Let's flood them with money so that they can be doing practical things that everyone agrees they should be doing, like capacity development. Give them golden handcuffs so that they're so busy doing capacity development that it's difficult for them to get involved in some of these areas. We really need to triple down on capacity development, especially giving focus to swing countries, especially in the non-aligned movement, Indonesia, India, Brazil, some of these countries that we can really come in. Let's explain to them what happened in this. Let's explain to them why this might have been okay and really try and get them on side. Last is when we talk about multi-stakeholder, there's two things that we can do with multi-stakeholder. One is my previous point. We love multi-stakeholder, but when we talk about international, but when we really look about U.S. and what we're going to do in the U.S., it's largely Washington, D.C. that knows what's going to do and what's going to happen next. When we made these decisions about espionage or Stuxnet, I bet none of those people in the room had spent a day in their life in their private sector. My time in the White House, I had spent 2 years at Goldman Sachs and with the financial services ISAC. I'd spent at that point 10 years as a signals intelligence officer. But I was pretty much the sole voice within the White House. The only people that had White House that had private sector experience were pretty much people that had been lawyers, that had been in private practice or worked for a firm, or people that had gotten an MBA. So we could use a little bit more multi-stakeholderism at home. Second, when we're thinking about internet governance, we tend to largely be thinking about the other governments. Good, what do we do about India and Indonesia, for example? And I think Gene made this point also, is let's also be aiming for the civil society part and getting a good message to them and to other international companies on what happened and why it's okay and why they should stay on side. sorry if that went a touch longer.
So both of you have alluded a little bit to this darker vision of a splintering internet. Mm. And so let's be a little dystopic at the moment and walk through that, because, Gene, one thing that concerns me in particular is there are going to be some countries that will be able to make their own internet, their own network, build their own industry, but there are going to be many that are not. Could you talk a little about how that might play out?
Well, I think it you can put it back into the division at the Dubai Treaty Conference. Yes, some can build their own, and yes, they are doing it, and they already have these ideas. And then a lot are either considering it or totally unable to and will be looking for allies. I would think we would want them to be allies of our philosophy of an open internet and not allies of a Chinese philosophy. And so there's an open discussion with, I think, two-thirds of the world here about how to do that expanded capacity, how to build but make it be an infrastructure and a platform that respects human rights, and how to balance national security surveillance needs with commercial and personal privacy and human rights. And so I think we are now going to go into this next phase of internet policy discussions, internet governance, with this hanging over our heads. And I think I couldn't agree more with every one of Jason's suggestions as to how to the U.S. government needs to start walking itself through this. And I think in doing that and trying to do it with the world watching, we stand the best chance of regaining our footing and building a much broader alliance around an open internet theory. Yeah.
And can I add, it's going to be very interesting. And there's been, I've heard informally about discussions that have happened with, for example, the Chinese since. And this doesn't appear to be dominating those conversations in, say, the way Stuxnet did. The Chinese understand domestic surveillance much better than us, and they might be beating us up in the press, and they might use it when they can find advantage of it. But there's a different message, what they're saying in the paper versus their actual position. And I think a lot of countries' governments might be seeing that in a similar way. So we might posit how this might affect internet governance, but it's going to be very interesting to see when it actually comes down to votes, for example, on ITU issues, how this is going to swing those votes. It might not be as severe as we think.
So following up on that, are there particular strategies we should be pursuing with Europe, with Russia, with Latin America? And are they different? And can you talk about what they might be? Or Gene, a few thoughts?
Well, and I know the U.S. government is looking to do this. And this is a general strategy, not necessarily tied to this, but making the economic case. You know, why an open, secure internet is better for you and is better for the world than a closed one. And a lot of countries will look at China that has internally a pretty dynamic internet. I mean, the Chinese internet pretty much rocks, and you can do largely what you need to do, even though many things are constrained. And a lot of countries will look at that and say, well, that's not bad. If my internet can only be as dynamic as China's, that's pretty good. So we really need to continue to make the economic case about why open internet will be even cooler than that. And I don't think we really have quite all of our economic ducks lined up in Iran yet.
Well, I agree with that, but I want to add on, there's a significant role for the U.S. corporate sector to play in this as well.
Yeah, that's
and that so. Is that you can say there's an economic interest here, and then when these countries look out and they say it is that panoply of companies that you described as being the image of the U.S., from Cisco across to Google, Yahoo, Microsoft, and they look at that and say, and they're out to gather all the information about my citizens, and then where does that go? So I think there's an important commercial interest here globally, and I hope U.S. corporations are thinking through this, that it's not just about their relationship with the NSA and the U.S. government that's at stake here, and whether they're being cooperative or fighting, and whether someone gets the next government contract that could be worth billions of dollars, or is in close with the government for other reasons they need to be thinking globally about how do I build the bridges with these other governments and earn the trust of people around the world. And that's where I found that a lot of the civil society organizations are both distrustful but recognize that they need to deal with the corporate sector. And they're looking for that conversation going forward because many of them don't trust their own governments. They're worried about what information their governments want to get hold of and what they want to control. And they love the image of the open internet and the democratization process that is promised to look like something like the U.S. or Western Europe, but they don't see the way to get from here to there. And I think that's where the corporate sector could play a much more valuable role.
So final question before we turn it over. We began this discussion by talking about the importance of narratives. And some of us are even guilty. You know, this panel is framed as the NSA versus the global free internet. And that's framed as a zero-sum game. Mm-hmm. One side must win, or one side must lose in order for the other side to win. Can we either reframe this or inject policy solutions that help move away from a zero-sum approach to some a situation where we don't have to go to the intelligence community and say, you need to give something up. You need to feel like you're doing less than everything you can to protect the country, or civil society organizations say, no, listen, we can expand the option set. Is there something we can do, either rhetorically or really?
We need to have a meaningful conversation in this country and globally about the digital world we live in. Mm-hmm. If we were to take this conversation back to the home and talk about search and seizure, and talk about whether we think it's appropriate for the government to be able to walk in your house. Oh, they can't look in every drawer, but they can just walk in your house when they have some suspicion that you somehow have some relationship to someone somewhere else in another country. Mm-hmm. The conversation would be dramatically different because we have a set of cultural expectations and understandings about the home. Well, what is the digital home in the 21st century? I think that's the conversation we need to have. There will always be a trade-off. It'll always be some balance. But this is really about a grounding in some understood limits that we don't go beyond. Mm-hmm. And that even everyone in the NSA understands that, mm-hmm. that this is just understood. And if we can get to a baseline of that and start building it, I think we have a chance of breaking through this trade-off barrier.
Yeah, and my preferred narrative, I mean, we're still trying to figure out what cyberspace is like because it's like many things, but it's really like nothing. Yep. And you see the DoD fighting over this. Is it a domain? You see the government, oh, my gosh, this is a global commons. And I always like thinking about it as an environment. You know what I mean? It is, and you've got lots of different kinds of pollution into it, like botnets and other things. It gives you great norms to talk about, especially when those environmental norms are inherently international. They're strongest in the millennials that have made cyberspace their home, but also it allows you to think about sustainable cyberspace, and I really like thinking about a sustainable cyberspace. How can we How can we help make sure that cyberspace is at least as awesome for our grandkids as it is for us? That it's at least as open, secure, free as it is for them, as it is for us now. And if you think about the sustainability, I think it helps you think through another way of this trade-off between privacy, security, and the rest. I heard someone at a recent conference out at Chatham House, and a professor was speaking and had this great view of balances of these trade-offs involved, and then made talking about resilience and the resilience of cyberspace, and then made this assertion that if you have one country that's reading others' emails, and cyberspace can't be resilient. Well, that's we might disagree with that as a value proposition. You might think it's not in line with human rights, but it certainly doesn't throw off the resilience of cyberspace. And so I think thinking through resilience and sustainable cyberspace helps say, does NSA what's doing at a large scale? Is it very bad? I think sustainability gives you a much better sense of the balances and the trade-offs to think about in a longer term. Thanks, Ellen.
So we can turn to the audience for questions, and there are a couple of traditions here at Brookings. First, it is customary to identify yourself, but given the nature of this, if you want to remain pseudonymous, you're welcome to. Second is that questions are relatively short. And third, they by custom end in an interrogative punctuation mark. And first, since we have some people standing in the back, I want to start if there are any questions back there. There's a young one with a mic.
One quick question. In terms of multi stakeholders and the international community, I'm curious if people are looking at what would happen if a hedge fund invested in a company that became a contractor with access to the personal emails of executives in a competing company. How would that affect how those executives might locate themselves in the world in terms of whether their information is available or the ability of a particular company to gain an advantage in a competitive market over its competitors by having access to the personal emails or the personal information of their competitors?
So does cloud enable economic espionage?
Yeah, I mean, I think there are so many ways to be sneaky in cyberspace. I just love it. There's so many ways, so many brilliant hacks out there, and to some degree, it's so much, and still the chances of getting caught are so thin that we're still going to have another 10 or 15 years, I'm afraid, of where the attacker really has the advantage in all sorts of ways to go about this.
Joel
Margolis Joel Margolis with Subsensio. I have a question for Mr. Kimmelman. For those of us who don't know much about the human rights treaties, what exactly is it about these NSA programs that violates the treaties?
Well, I would say it's unclear, and that's why you have human rights activists and groups around the world directing pointed questions at the U.S. to explain how their behavior is consistent with the treaties. But it is fundamentally in gathering personal information about law-abiding citizens. I mean, just think of it this way. Imagine if you're sitting here in the U.S. and someone says, by the way, India's got all your Yahoo, AOL, Google, Facebook material because they have some investigation going on about somebody somewhere in the U.S. who they think is a terrorist, and all your stuff got swept up in. By the way, you have no legal rights in India that we know of, and we're not sure what they're going to do with it. How would you feel? Well, you might say people around the world should feel like the U.S. would never do anything horrible with that. I'm sorry to say that's not how they feel. It's not how a lot of them feel. So that is the problem. It is this uncertainty around the massive gathering of information of some level, we don't know the detail, or how massive it was, but it certainly was portrayed that way. And I think they want an accounting for how this is consistent, really, first with U.S. law and then with these international principles. It may be easy. This may be a piece of cake for the U.S. government to do once they can declassify enough information to talk about it. But it's not clear yet.
Yeah, and just to play on India, because as I was talking to Indian companies over the years, they said, look, our security is going to be so good because we know if there are mishaps, then companies won't trust us holding their data anymore. If this happened in India, especially, say, 10 years ago, India would dry up on IT because a lot of companies would just say, why would we ever send our data there? I think the U.S. is hoping, well, we're not India, we're the U.S. Of course they're going to continue to send our data here. And to some degree, that's a gamble, right? To see if that's actually going to hold up.
We do know a decent amount about some aspects of how countries around the world have asked large web companies to cooperate. And it comes down to, I think, a pretty simple power calculation. When the country is more powerful than the company complies. And when the large multinational corporation is able to leverage its own power, then it can stick with its own values. Yes, in the back there, black shirt on the eye.
What's the likelihood that the internet will devolve into a series of national nets surrounded by electronic fences? And I'm specifically interested because the countries show differences on the content question, religion, politics, pornography. They're concerned about privacy, cybersecurity, and interception. We found from Denmark that they can isolate companies from the internet, and we find from Pakistan that they're doing a very effective job of controlling the entry of data into their country.
Yeah, it's certainly more likely today than it was 3 months ago. The kind of what came out of the wicket was this discussion. One of my colleagues, Alexander Klimberg, did a great paper called The Internet Yalta, where he talks about, you know, in the real Yaltas, both sides really figured out, or the West really figured out, wow, you're going in a different direction than us. And my colleague Alex really talks about how wicket was really that, where the two positions have really come together. I recommend that as a paper. Also, The Economist, it was maybe 2 years ago now, had a great piece on the Balkanized Internet where they talked through these implications. I still consider, you know, and if I were going to roll the dice, I'd say maybe 1 in 3 chance that we're going to end up in that direction. I would also caution to not just look at national internets, but walled gardens of any kind. I mean, it started the internet, you know, many people were locked up in AOL and, you know, never really got to the real internet because they were in AOL. And you're starting to see some of those areas now. You know, Apple's got its own place where you can largely live within Apple content for long periods of time. Certainly Facebook has places where you can spend most of your time in there, and it's not easy to transfer data inside and out of that. And so we shouldn't just be looking at the national firewalls.
I think part of it, if I just add, part of it depends on the model of control that a country or an organization requires. Many, if not most, national programs are circumventable without too much difficulty. Certainly anyone who sort of has 1 year of computer science should be able to do it. The goal of the government isn't perfect protection, oddly enough, because ironically digital systems enable perfect protection in some areas like copyright or perfect breaking. But a lot of the national protection, you're okay as long as you make it difficult for most people. Yeah. You can still impose control. Now, that's less true for something like cross-border data flow of business information. Mm-hmm. When you say, no, we need everything to have control for fiduciary reason.
And I'm sorry if I can come back to that. You know, the borders aren't new. Back to Yahoo in France, if I remember right. Yahoo had a small auction site, and you could find Nazi memorabilia. France started taking suit about that, saying that that is illegal in France, and Yahoo and the rest of California were up in arms. This is the internet. It has no borders. You can't do this, until they realized they had to do it, and then they erected such borders. That was 99?
98 was the case. 98? It was filed. It wasn't resolved for quite some time. Both sides lost.
Yeah. And, this isn't new that countries have mostly porous, but still some borders.
Questions? Oh my God. On the front here.
Thank you. Philip Corwin, Virtual Law. There was mention of ICANN at the beginning of this and none since. So let me raise a question. I have no doubt that some parties will try to capitalize on what's happened and suggest that this is a rationale for transferring ICANN's domain name addressing functions over to some other group. But isn't that a red herring? And without going into all the things that have happened in the past few years in which ICANN is distancing itself from its U.S. origins, had ICANN's functions been transferred to the ITU several years ago, it would have had zero impact on the NSA's ability to conduct the surveillance, and it would have zero impact on what parties in other countries may choose to do or not do in reaction to the revelation of the PRISM program.
I mean, I think that ICANN becomes much less significant in this debate as people worry about what the NSA is or isn't doing. But I think the rhetoric is all very similar. And I think it's the thing that came to mind as you said that, Phil, was the kill switch, the U.S. kill switch over the Internet. And this image is still out there. It's, you know, U.S. control of the Internet. And I think the debate will now shift to much more salient, substantive issue areas for people around the world. But ICANN will still be used. It'll be thrown out there. Even though I don't think it's nearly as significant as it originally was portrayed.
And I agree with your point. I mean, ICANN in this doesn't particularly play, but it is a place where if you think America is a general hegemon as well as a very specifically cyber hegemon, then if you can start prying ICANN farther away from the United States government, then that would surely be a good thing under that mindset.
So in the back, standing in the white.
John Reed with Foreign Policy Magazine. We hear from the businesses who are forced to provide customer information to the government that they scrub, their legal departments scrub and look at every single request they receive. I mean, how do they manage to do that when they get thousands, if not tens of thousands, of these requests every single year? I mean, have you heard anything on that to suggest that they can do that with that volume of requests from the government?
I'm not sure either. Yeah, I don't know their specific processes for this, but you're right. I mean, it either has to be tremendously at scale to make sure that they can do this and they meet these requests. I mean, let's look at it from a different direction. I mean, we get, you know, when I was working for the bank, I mean, we would get requests for information pursuant to an investigation all of the time, and it would be, we had a team that it was just their job to find emails and other documents that were pursuant to this or that legal paper that had come in. And at some point, even though it's completely side to our main line of business, we had to have a full team with a largely automated process. We had to change the way that we did backup and archiving and retrieval so that we could meet that in a timely fashion. In a way that would meet our legal requirements. I'll bet that these companies over time have continued to spend money to build out their teams so that they can do this in a timely manner and in a way that they feel is in line with their corporate social responsibilities or their responsibility to their customers.
So we've heard from two companies explicitly asking the federal government for permission to tell more about what they do because they're not allowed to say anything. And it would be great to hear even more people joining that call. Scrubbing actually here we might think of it as a two-way street, because another thing we don't know is how much information is shared with the company. Is there some cryptographic fashion that allows the company to not really understand what it's providing to the government? Certainly, you could look at the slides that were leaked and interpret it from that perspective. And the other challenge is, unfortunately, when we talk about scrubbing, of stripping of some of the data, we might imagine that's data that people want. So, for example, data from Facebook, it's one thing to say, what is my communication, what is my content? But as we know from lots of other attempts from the private sector and the public sector to get data from Facebook, the social data, the social graph, is actually the really valuable stuff. So they may not be allowed to scrub some of the things we might hope they would. Standing in the dark shirt.
This is a related question, possibly for Gene, but with regard to the corporation's perspective and moving towards emerging best practices, what role do you think transparency reporting will play, kind of like what we've seen from Google and Twitter, and or a move more towards the process behind how they receive these requests and their reactions to it rather than just aggregate data reporting that they've been doing?
I think it's a great question. I mean, I think you need both. You need the data reporting, but I think we're at a point now where the public now knows that all this information is gathered, something experts have known for a long time, and they now are worried as to whose hands it's in, and experts have known for quite a while that it gets into many people's hands. So I think we're at a point now where it's not just some aggregate numbers, this many requests, this many accounts, the transparency reports are good, but I fear that's not enough. I think there needs to be a much more deep discussion about how do you honor the privacy of your customers? Or for the government, how do you protect privacy as you also try to make sure you are protecting national security? And walking through more of the process and the nature of the checks and balances that are applied so people get some understanding, how many people have access to my information? How much of my information? Is this supervised? By whom? Is there ultimately some independent third party that is looking at it? We've heard about companies worrying about their competitors. Well, you know, there are needs for certain third-party audits, possibly. Not the government and everything, but just some accountability to a public that gives people confidence. I mean, this is all about norm setting and kind of the culture of the cyber space. And we're learning it as we go, but I think we need to take it very seriously that we have to have an open discussion about it and get a feel for how those checks and balances are actually put in place and portrayed and discussed with the public.
question in the middle here. Oops. Or not. Hands on the wall there.
Hi, Daniel Mason from University of Pittsburgh. I have a question about the implications regarding foreign policy. So we use organizations like Radio Free Asia, the Middle East Broadcasting Network, to promote free expression and open news and information. Do you think these revelations about the PRISM program and the NSA scandal have any – I mean, what are your interpretations of the implications of these revelations on those organizations that we use and our moral authority in the world when it comes to expression and freedom of, you know, information?
Mm-hmm. I think it's too soon to know. I mean, I think it depends on how those organizations describe what is happening and help the world understand what the U.S. government is doing and what corporate entities in the U.S. are doing with personal information of people from abroad. And so it's as much not what they're... I mean, I think everyone's image is tarnished just by the nature of the media cycle and how this has been portrayed. But that's not the end of the story. It's now a story of what are we going to do to explain what happened and explain what needs to happen going forward. If those entities are part of that forward movement and are open and transparent with people around the world, I think they gain credibility.
Yes, front here.
Hi, Carolina Rossini from New America. My question is for both of you. So we just today discovered that in Brazil, I'm originally from Brazil, they are being our Intel agency has implemented some surveillance on social media because of the protests on the streets we are having. So I bring this up, why? You are talking about cyberspace has economic force intervening and increasing that cyberspace, mm-hmm. right? And Google, Twitter, Facebook, and now eBay are exponential growth in Brazil. So if that surveillance is over there also, what does that mean for American companies, right? And what is the role that U.S. should have in preventing that type of surveillance in markets that are so important for your own companies?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, to some degree, it depends what we mean by surveillance of social media. I mean, boy, that sounds really terrible, right, to have the National Security Services, the police, surveil media. And that's probably even the words they would use themselves, because they tend to be militarized type, you know, Roger, affirmative, we will surveil the target kinds of guys. And but a lot of time that just means looking at your Facebook page. And a lot of time, well, I don't want to say a lot of times, frequent when I've seen these stories about this terrible Big Brother surveillance on these groups, it's no, they're reading your webpage and they're following your tweets. And I just can't get that worked up about that. So whenever you see those headlines, first is, all right, are they submitting requests to Twitter to get things? Are they getting things that wouldn't otherwise be public? It is really one of the first order questions to be asking. Is this something that you've already started to share with the world, but it just wasn't that Big Brother was one of your followers, so you didn't know they were going to get it? If that's the case, I'll leave it to the pirate parties of the world to get, and John Perry Barlow to get really upset by that, because I can't get there just yet. If it's more than that, if it's, social already sort of means sharing, but I mean, if it's much more intrusive than that, then you're starting to, is it fitting within the proper procedure within the legal aspects of that culture? The U.S. got caught up in this. Actually, I think it was a protest in Pittsburgh, if I remember right, that people were listening to police scanners and tweeting where police barricades were going to be and where they were going to hit, you know, come at demonstrators in different areas. And the person that was tweeting that actually got arrested, but I don't think it went any farther than that. So it even happens in the U.S. for someone that's just tweeting what they're hearing on, you know, an unencrypted radio. And got arrested, and then it looks like we backed off of that. So we're still figuring this out between the people that say, look, it's public, versus the others. It's interesting to see how this fits in with GPS tracking and other areas.
Gene, comments on
that? I will say an observation. There's also a business model issue here. That's the whole culture of cyberspace. But I think of the banking industry. How long did it take to get people willing to put their credit card number online for transactions in the financial services world? Or do their banking online? I mean, this was a huge psychological barrier here for a lot of good reasons. People were worried about somebody getting their personal information. I think the banking industry, the financial services sector, really took it upon themselves to do a lot to protect their customers and to make sure that if there was hacking in and stealing, which happens apparently a lot, they're protected.
Not in my bank.
But that's not the business model that everyone is practicing in the digital age and the Internet of Things and the online world. And so it may not fit for everyone. But that was this comes up with medical records as well. So there's an interesting question here for the corporate sector of, you know, what is your business model? And for a while, people might be happy to just throw their stuff out there on Facebook. Or as Eric Schmidt says, you know, you put it out there, what do you expect? Well, maybe people do expect more. And that's something we're going to need to monitor.
So, Gene, I want to follow up on that and ask you to wear an older hat. Because while the financial service community does take security very seriously, the real reason why no one should be afraid of banking online is because we have excellent consumer protection laws.
Absolutely.
That say if I wake up tomorrow morning and all of my money has been sent to Moldova, I will go in and say, I don't have any more money. And they'll say, but Alan, did you send all your money to Moldova? And I'll say, no. And then they'll put every dollar of that back in my account.
That's right.
Is there some sort of consumer protection model we could begin to think about in this space for cloud computing, social media?
I think we should have the discussion. I would love to say that the reason all that protection is there is because the consumer movement is so powerful in the United States that it... I don't believe that's fully true. I think the financial sector and members of Congress who all have credit cards and have bank accounts all understood that this was an important thing to do. And there were fights and there's a lot of disagreement to this day. But there were some understandings that there were going to need to be some protections. I think we probably have to have that conversation for the online world as well.
Yeah. I'm also very curious as more millennials come in and become into positions of power, how this is going to change. You know, I mean... You know, I came into, like many of us, cyberspace, you know, not in my teens, but considerably later. And so it'll be very curious to see how the newer generations deal with these issues, because it's not really going to be us that's going to be deciding what we think about police surveillance of social media. It's going to be the newer generations.
Yes, in the pink. Possibly a millennial. Who can tell us?
Yes, a millennial. Hi, I'm Danielle. I'm a law student. This question is for either one of you. It seems like in dealing with NSA possibly overstepping its boundaries, we've been using a lot of rights rhetoric. So saying, you know, we need to explain why it's legal, why it's constitutional in the U.S. and why it doesn't violate human rights outside of the U.S. But I guess my question is, do we need to go beyond the legal framework? Leave it to me to ask this question.
In the explanations or in what
right,
we do?
Right, so I mean... In justifying this to the people whose privacy might be invaded, you know, it might be legal to have this sort of surveillance industrial complex, but is it against democracy? Do we need to go beyond a legal justification?
Industrial complex. Do you want to go? I mean, I've got some, but I'll let you go.
Well, I think it's an appropriate part of the debate. I don't know the dividing line between legal, constitutional, and other values. I would hope we've gathered a lot of them in those documents. But I will interpret your question this way. I think that there are a lot of commercial needs, both from the seller side and the consumer side, that require a lot of trust and a lot of desire to engage. And it's really that set of needs on both sides that I think ought to be addressed on top of law and constitution, that we need to look for a way of making the cyber world a really attractive place for people to be and to feel comfortable and protected and look for greater commercial opportunities on the seller side.
Yeah, and the It's a great question, Danielle. And so I feel pretty confident on both this program as well as Stuxnet. We're well within U.S. law on this. Our colleague Stuart Baker pointed out in his very good, I think it was foreign policy piece, that you know this was three branches of the U.S. government, both parties, and two presidents had this program. And if that's not within line of the Constitution, then what else can you do? And then I thought that was, I saw that very early on, and that was very influential to me when I was thinking about the legality and the constitutionality about it. About human rights overseas, I wouldn't contend that it necessarily is or isn't. I haven't thought much about it. And if you believe human rights gives you a right to be forgotten, and many in Europe now do believe that to be the case, then clearly NSA remembering when you want to be forgotten is going to be irreconcilable, I would guess. But also, you've heard most of my arguments have been the other side. To me, the future in cyberspace is still a jump ball, right? I mean, we still don't know how this domain, how this environment is going to go. And it turns out it might be much more sensitive to attacks like Stuxnet, to large-scale espionage of this kind, than what you suspect. Either the technical dynamics or the political dynamics or the general human dynamics of it might be much more sensitive than we suspect. And the impacts of this could be much greater than we would anticipate than if this happened in air, land, or sea, or if this happened in the cyberspace that people like me grew up with. You know, General Alexander's cyberspace that he grew up with and most of the colonels, generals, and intel chiefs, they didn't grow up with it, and they might not fully understand the outrage that can get generated from this, because we're still thinking about telephones and copper wires. So I do believe that this was almost certainly overly aggressive, same way I believe about Stuxnet, in ways that ultimately might not be in the U.S.'s longer-term national security interest.
I just want to take issue with one piece of that.
Oh, reason. Good.
And that is, there's another element of legality, and that is this what Congress thought it was doing with the Patriot Act and with the Surveillance Act?
Yeah.
And is this going beyond accepted interpretation of what is the appropriate balance and proportionality of how the government should balance these issues? And that's the debate that I think will go on in Congress. I think that's the debate the executive branch needs to engage in now. And I think that's going to be a critical element to get at whether this is truly acceptable.
And in Snowden's defense, I mean, so for this person that purports to be a whistleblower.
Almost made it without actually mentioning his name.
I would think that he would make part of his defense. Look, American congressmen were saying that they were constrained to talk about this by secrecy. I am not acting out here in a rogue way. I am releasing this information that congressmen have said they don't believe is in line with true American values. I was kind of following their lead in doing what they were practically calling me to do. I wouldn't say that's necessarily going to do them much good in U.S. court, but I would think there's a defense, and the lawyers will mug me after this, whether that's true or not.
So we have time for, I think, one very quick question here in the front. And while that's Mike getting to point people to my colleague's website, Lawfare, has had some excellent discussions on this, but most of them are going to agree with Jay.
Quickly, Carl Johnson, General Alexander's been mentioned several times. Hell of a nice guy. But should the person who's wearing the cap of head of cyber command for the DOD also be wearing the cap as head of the National Security Agency?
Small question, JC.
Can I take this? I've got a piece that's hopefully coming out in National Interest one of these days that looks at that question. Actually, we even wrote it beforehand because the future for cyberspace. So right now, U.S. Cyber Command, the military punching part and defense part, has the same general, the same head as the director of the National Security Agency, because NSA has the bulk of the capability in, well, the world. And so it made a lot of sense. There had already been talk about splitting those into separating them off and to be different leaders. That was already, I thought, a leading contender for the way that it might go, because you generally don't have intel four-star generals, and you don't have intel generals running warfighting commands. So I already thought there was already a running set of energy to break those up. I don't see how you don't break them up now. If the president is having to get up repeatedly in front of national leaders and have to talk about your program, I don't even know how he still has his job. And so I would think any future president, especially this president, General Alexander has said he's going to retire in early 2014. I don't see how he can say this wouldn't have happened if he had fully kept his eye on the job at NSA. I think that's a tough case for him to make. And I would think the president, having had to apologize and talk about this, is going to want a general, a three-star general, that does this full-time so that he doesn't have to deal with this crap when he's talking to foreign leaders anymore.
Gene, anything?
That's a good wrap-up.
So I think one of the interesting things about this conversation is, first, we can actually talk about this without, until the very end, touching on the normative question of, is this good or bad? It's all right. No. I think it's good to mention it, and we have excellent people to talk about it here. But we can have this discussion about what it means independent of the discussion of the actual programs. I think it's very important. Or pole dancing, right? We can leave that to another discussion as well. Second, again, for these discussions, we have to recognize that there's an area outside the boundaries of this country, and our decisions are very, very important, and increasingly more important, reflected in the opinions of those around the world. And finally, I think this is a great point that both of you highlighted, is the decisions that are being made have to have people other than the pure intelligence world. They have to have people in the room who have this broader perspective. So I want to thank Gene and Jason for helping us get a broader perspective today, and I hope you'll join me.
Thank you so much.